NPR.
This is The Indicator from Planet Money. I'm Weilin Wong.
And I'm Paddy Hirsch. When the Taliban took over Afghanistan in August of 2021, they gained control over every branch of government and all of its related assets, with the exception of one, the Afghan central bank's foreign reserve account, totaling a whopping $9 billion.
Those reserves were built up by previous Afghan governments and kept in banks in the U.S. and Europe. But when the Taliban took power, the reserves were frozen. The U.S. refused to recognize the Afghan government and, by extension, denied the Afghan central bank access to its own holdings, which means that for the last year, Afghanistan's foreign reserves have been in limbo.
Until earlier this month, when the U.S. government announced that half of the reserves kept in the U.S., it's like $3.5 billion, will be sent to a fund in Switzerland for the benefit, the U.S. says, of the Afghan people.
So on today's show, the Afghan Central Bank reserves. What they are, where they are, and why the Afghans can't have them.
Or not on the Taliban's terms, at least.
That's coming up after the break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Lincoln Financial. Sure, you could invest in something that says it will go to the moon, but what about a plan that takes care of you and your family here on Earth? Lincoln Financial has annuities and life insurance policies designed to protect your financial future against risky trends. Go to lincolnfinancial.com/protection to see how they can help you plan, protect, and retire. Lincoln Financial products issued by the Lincoln National Life Insurance Company, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and Lincoln Life and Annuity Company of New York, Syracuse, New York. Distributed by Lincoln Financial Distributors, member FINRA.
The first thing to understand about this is why there was so much Afghan money in New York in the first place.
Central banks work hard to build up and maintain their foreign reserves. And they do this for several reasons. Among the biggest, to finance imports and cover deficits, to service their dollar-denominated debts, and to help support the currencies. Because the best way to fight a falling currency, or keep it liquid, is to buy it with dollars or euros on the open market.
And because all of those functions take place outside a country's borders, it makes sense for a central bank to keep a chunk of its reserves outside the country's borders too. William Byrd is an economist and a senior expert at the Institute of Peace.
Many, many countries in the world keep a large portion of their foreign exchange reserves and gold reserves, which Afghanistan had as well, for safekeeping in foreign central banks.
William says that the Afghan Central Bank, aka Da Afghanistan Bank, or DAB, did an unusually good job of building up its reserves over the years before the Taliban took over. In fact, it amassed $9 billion by 2021.
A country in a normal situation, I would say you might want 6 months' worth of imports, at least 4 months' worth of imports as your reserves. And Afghanistan's total reserves are probably closer to a year's worth of imports.
The problem with keeping your money in a foreign bank, however, is that if you fall out with the country where you're keeping your cash, the government of that country might not permit you to access your account. That's what happened in large part to Russia's central bank when it invaded Ukraine. And it's what happened to Afghanistan's DAB when it was taken over by the Taliban.
And a lack of financial resources has become a huge problem for Afghanistan, which the United Nations says is experiencing close to 40% unemployment, a 50% decline in households receiving remittances, 25 million people living in poverty, and more than half the population in need of humanitarian assistance.
Many organizations are pointing the finger at the U.S. government and the freezing of those DAB reserves. But William Byrd says the blame is misdirected.
It's really important for people to understand that it's not the freezing of the reserves that caused the Afghan economic collapse. It was the abrupt stoppage of all aid and also international military expenditures, with the aid amounting to about $8 billion every year, and international military expenditures, you know, the base expenditures, logistics, and all that, easily equal or more than that.
William says in one fell swoop, Afghanistan lost as much as $15 billion in annual capital inflows because donors didn't want to support the Taliban.
And that was a huge shock for a country that's GDP was probably in the range of $20 billion, generally in that range. No country in the world could have, you know, absorbed that shock without enormous losses.
The DAB reserves weren't part of that aid package, but aid groups and a group of 70 international economists, including the Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz, argue that the freezing of reserves was just as damaging to the Afghan economy as the cutting off of aid.
Their argument was that every country actually needs a central bank, and the central bank needs reserves. If it doesn't have any reserves, then it's essentially bankrupt, and that can have very bad effects on the economy.
And the Afghan economy is not doing well, but it's doing a lot better than a lot of people expected, mainly because the Taliban's proved adept at collecting taxes and enforcing customs tariffs. But because the central bank's coffers are frozen, Afghanistan has struggled to do a number of things: stabilize its currency, steady the banking system, and fight inflation, which has soared at least 18% this year.
Unfreezing the reserves might help with all of this, but William says the argument to do so ignores several things. First, the issue of the legal claims against the Taliban.
Any attempt to send that money directly to the Taliban would have been stayed by a federal court.
He says if the Biden administration had released all the funds to the DAB, it would have immediately triggered a lawsuit brought by relatives of victims of the September the 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks. They are fighting to seize that money to pay off judgment debts from lawsuits that find the Taliban, among others, responsible for their losses. Allowing the DAB access to the reserves would have required the courts to put a stay on all the funds, effectively freezing everything until the civil case was concluded.
The second thing the economist didn't take into account, he says, is the current inability of the DAB to operate effectively.
Well, they've lost a large, probably the majority of their professional, technical, and managerial staff. The leadership of the bank is largely members of the Taliban, including a deputy governor who's sanctioned by the U.S., the U.N., and the European Union. And they do have some technocrats left, but there are real capacity problems.
The DAB's anti-money laundering capacity has stalled, he says, and there's been a dramatic brain drain as intellectuals and technocrats have fled the country. He says there are real questions about the DAB's capacity to manage that kind of money.
And the third issue with unfreezing the reserves, William says, is if the U.S. returns the funds to the Afghan central bank, it will be implicitly recognizing the Taliban government.
Yeah, and the U.S. is not about to recognize a government that it says oppresses women, fails to protect humanitarian workers, frustrates the allocation of aid, and harbors terrorists. And then there's this. William says a big concern is that the Afghan government might mismanage the funds in such a way that the Afghan people don't actually benefit from them.
If you use them up quickly, you get a quick fix, and then the economy is still no better than before.
And of course, the U.S. doesn't trust the Taliban or the DAB not to use up these funds in a quick fix of some kind, which is where the Swiss Trust comes in. By leaving half the reserves in New York for 9/11 victims' families to fight over, President Biden frees up $3.5 billion that can be used for the Afghan people.
And by using a trust in Switzerland to disperse that money, he essentially creates a shadow Afghan central bank. Mm-hmm. Not that this trust will be doing everything that a central bank does, but William says it will do some of it.
The objective is to preserve and to use for targeted central bank-like uses of small amounts of the money, that is to pay international debts, perhaps to finance some imports, pay for currency printing and things like that, but without going directly through the Afghan central bank.
It's kind of like someone whose brother dies, right, and they inherit the family money. But the manager of the bank holding the money thinks that this guy's a reprobate who's not going to spend the money responsibly and certainly not on his children. So the bank manager sets up a trust to manage the money, to spend it on the kids' education and their annual camps and such, and to prevent their feckless father from frittering it away.
The Swiss Trust will be administered by two Afghans, as well as representatives from the U.S. and Switzerland. William says down the line, it's possible that a judge could rule that the $3.5 billion left in New York can't be claimed in a civil suit. If that happens, the entire $7 billion, and possibly the $2 billion that's in Europe, would all be managed by the Swiss Trust. And perhaps eventually...
At some point, if the Afghan government becomes... again, recognizable and as a functioning autonomous central bank, then this money perhaps eventually could be moved back into the central bank.
That is the hope, he says. But right now, given the state of things in Afghanistan, it's not something that's even on the horizon.
This show was produced and fact-checked by Noah Glick, with engineering by Gilly Moon. Viet Le is our senior producer, Kate Kincannon edits the show, and The Indicator is a production of NPR.